Major funding for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities. From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. For Black History Month 1990, the third in a series of discussions this week on Soundings. The program at hand focuses on the literary history of the Caribbean. My guest is James Arnold of the University of Virginia. Following that discussion, Soundings will conclude with commentary by Beverly Jones of North Carolina Central University. Her topic will be social equity in the United States today. During his fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, James Arnold is working on a project entitled Rewriting the Caribbean. Jim Arnold, welcome to Soundings. Let's begin with this. The Caribbean's been around a long time. How come we're just getting around to its literary history?
I think the quick answer to that has to do with the multiplicity and the complexity of the colonial history of the Caribbean. It was colonized by 4, 5, 6 European powers. We tend to forget about the Danish and the Swedes these days. Okay. But everybody knows about the British in the West Indies, the French, the Spanish, and some of us remember that the Dutch not only were there, but still are there in the Netherlands Antilles in one way or another.
All right, now you're breaking this down. Let's look at it linguistically, first of all. Mm-hmm. We've got French, English, Spanish, Dutch. Those are the principal languages that you're working with?
Right. And then there are also, go rapidly, we'll call them the various creoles derived from those languages. Uh-huh. French-based creoles are pretty well known. The thing that deserves mention, perhaps, is that singularly there is no Hispanic creole in the Caribbean. The Spanish seem to have been far more successful in adopting and working out a West Indian Spanish that is part of the larger world of Hispanic literature and language.
By that you mean what? There's a sort of uniformity
yes.
to the Spanish.
Yes, whereas other languages have diverged much more greatly and profoundly. Uh-huh. We would need to talk about West Indian English, for starters.
Why is that? Why is that peculiar or important?
Well, because it is so much a part of the literature. When you read Annie John, for instance, by Jamaica Kincaid, you need to be aware of particular West Indian inflections in English in order to get the full Caribbean flavor mm-hmm. of that novel. Similarly, perhaps, one would need to talk eventually about the presence of Creole in such poets as Derek Walcott, who many consider to be the greatest living poet in the English language, mm-hmm. A very Caribbean poet whose mother tongue is a French-based Creole, although he was born in an officially English-speaking island, St. Lucia.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, Jim Arnold, before we talk about some of the concerns and themes, the substance of Caribbean literature, give me very quickly a time frame and a geographical sense of what you have in mind with this this really rather immense project, Rewriting the Caribbean. You're looking at hundreds of years and many different geographical points. Spell that out for me.
Sure. You're quite right to say that that it is vast, both in time and in space. The time frame involved, in principle, goes from shortly after the so-called discovery of the Americas by Columbus uh-huh. to the day before yesterday.
But shouldn't we use the word encounter? Mm-hmm. Isn't that the fashionable term these days?
Yes. We hope, by the way, to have the first volume of this literary history of the Caribbean out by the 500th anniversary of that famous encounter in 1992.
Very good.
And much will be said about that then, and we hope to be part of that great celebration of the Americas.
So we move from the 15th century, what, right into the present moment?
Yes, and in point of fact, as a practical matter, this literary history is going to be much more heavily weighted on the recent past, on literature of the 20th century, during that period where Caribbean literatures begin to emerge as literatures in their own right and not some sort of colonial extension of metropolitan literature.
Yeah, and for another reason, compelling reason there, is the what? Lack or the presence of evidence, the documentation, the stuff that you work with.
In some cases, that's true, of course. In others, it's true that literatures in some of the Creoles is a very recent formation.
Uh-huh.
We would need to talk concerning the geographic distribution about the north coast of South America, the Guyanas more particularly, stretching as far west as the Caribbean coast of Colombia, as a part of our purview.
Mm-hmm.
To cite an example that will be obvious to most of our listeners, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, who spent most of the summer of 1989 on the top of everybody's bestseller list with Love in the Time of Cholera.
Mm-hmm.
Garcia Marquez, who is generally considered to be a Latin American author and is, has nonetheless always considered himself to be a Caribbean writer. He enters into our purview as a Caribbean author, mm-hmm. as does Wilson Harris from Guyana, as does Bertin Juminaire from Guyane Française, and writers who are as yet little translated and therefore unknown from present-day Suriname, former Dutch Guiana.
What about a writer like Carlos Fuentes? Would you consider him part of this rewriting the history, the literary history of the Caribbean? For example, what do you do with Mexico, that one isolated example?
As much as I admire Fuentes, I don't think that there will be much about Fuentes or his work in this literary history.
That is not part of the Caribbean for your purposes.
Fuentes and what he does is not really.
Mm-hmm.
In theory, the Mexican coast of the Yucatan is. The problem is that we're really talking more about oral tradition and less about a literary culture in mm-hmm. that region.
Mm-hmm.
We had a symposium on this subject at the University of Puerto Rico in Rio Piedras in the spring of 1988, and two scholars currently working in the Yucatan came to talk about that, and I think the end result was that we're not going to have a whole lot to put into this history from the Yucatan, although we have explored it mm-hmm. as part of our purview.
All right, well, let's talk about some of the themes and the preoccupations, the directions that Caribbean literature takes or has taken. Do we talk about the family? Do we talk about religion? Do we talk about the aesthetic? Many, many directions that you can take this thing. And for example, Jim Arnold, I'm looking at the table of contents. What do I see?
I think I'm going to skip the table of contents right now, Wayne,
okay.
Because if I get into it, we'll spend the whole rest of this interview talking about the table of contents. That's how complicated it is.
Fair enough.
But I can pick up your question as regards theme and say, yes, of course, family issues are everywhere. But I might be able to be more helpful if I respond to the question of religion.
Hmm.
I think we're going to find this literary history to be of value to us in North America, perhaps more in the area of religion than in other areas. What I mean is that in the Caribbean, perhaps more so than in other areas of the Americas, we are made aware of the necessity of considering syncretic religions as indigenous to the Americas.
All right, now let's stop on that 50-cent term. Syncretic, what do
sure.
you mean?
Having been put together in a new place out of elements that have arrived from elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
The example that has a gory image in the American consciousness, wrongly so, I hasten to add, is that of voodoo in Haiti, which is a proper religion and not some sort of bloodthirsty cult. Candomblé in the northeast of Brazil, like Macumba also in Brazil, like various of the Afro-Caribbean religions in Haiti.
Mm-hmm.
It is a syncretic religion in this sense that it evolved in the practices of African Americans in the Caribbean drawing upon what was remembered and what could be pieced together from religious practices drawn from various parts of Africa.
All right, now let's pause on this a moment, Jim Arnold. When you present things like Macumba and Voodoo and, you know, these Brazilian variations, these syntheses of mm-hmm. Christianity and mm-hmm. African-American mm-hmm. religious symbology and belief, are you attempting in your anthology to justify them, to present them, to defend them? Are you saying, in effect, to the reader, here it is, you make up your mind? Are you saying, let's look at it strictly on its aesthetic terms? You run the risk of what? An ideological dimension here, do you not?
You're quite right to put the question of ideology in the center of this. There's no way of avoiding it.
Yeah.
In fact, I would have to say that there are represented in the scholarly points of view that will find their way into this literary history a great many ideological positions. As general editor of this literary history, one of my jobs is to help to create balance. As well as a representative presence of points of view.
And what kinds of voices in the present do you listen to as you make those decisions?
Let me go back to the way you put your question about ideology and religion. We have to find some sort of balance between the way in which religion is incorporated in aesthetic form mm-hmm. in the novel, poetry, and theatrical works. On the other hand, we must be very attentive to the function, or rather the functions, that religion serves in various parts of the Caribbean over a long period of time. The question, for instance, of the link between reggae as a musical form, its presence in a literary form like Michael Thelwell's fictional version of The Harder They Come, and the current sociological role of the Rastafari in Jamaica, all of that is somehow tied together. And it's necessary to try to make sense of it in ways that are neither too closely linked to the island where this religious syncretism was born, in this case Jamaica, and to try to see what sorts of bridges exist to other areas of the Caribbean.
Jim Arnold, I want you to be very specific for me. Give me a concrete example of a writer, a theme, a poem, a novel that you have come across here as you are putting this literary history together, something that really sticks in your mind that you have enjoyed.
I'd like to take a very broad one, Wayne, that may not have been your purpose in asking me the question, but I think it may take us farther in the long run. A term that has become so well known in North America that in 1968 the American Heritage Dictionary chose to write it without the original French accent, the term négritude, refers to all kinds of phenomena of foregrounding of ethnicity in the Caribbean. It begins its life just before and during World War II on the island of Martinique with a writer who is a favorite of mine, Aimé Césaire, who coined the term in the Paris of the 1930s when he was a student and reading his work to and being read to by his great friend, the African Léopold Sédar Senghor. Between them, they are largely responsible for the tremendous impact that term has had both in the Americas and in Africa in the last 25 years.
Well, now, when Césaire coined this term, negritude, what was its connotation? Was he being sarcastic, ironic? Did he imply a political dimension? What did he mean by it? To the extent that you can, you know, nail something like that down. What does it mean to us today?
At the risk of appearing coy, I wrote a 300-page book on this question that was published by Harvard in 1981. So we're going to have to boil this down quite a lot.
All right.
Césaire, when he and Senghor came up with this term, were already using something that had come to them from North America, more specifically from the Harlem Renaissance.
Hmm.
And this reaffirmation of blackness in American literature through the Harlem Renaissance itself had a Caribbean origin in the work of Claude McKay, who, as a member of the Harlem Renaissance, brought his own Jamaican sensibility to North American literature and culture in Harlem.
Talk about cross currents back and forth.
Exactly, and it doesn't stop there. I've spent some time looking at the later re-importation of Negritude into North America in the guise of Black Power in the 1960s.
Hmm.
Where a term that had originally a more broadly cultural intention was then reinterpreted in a more fundamentally political sense by the advocates of Black Power in the 1960s. And there, another Martinican name, that of Frantz Fanon, must be listed alongside Aimé Césaire's as having been a fundamental, basic transmitter of these ideas of ethnic particularism. Now, you ask about the political implications. For a time, for a rather long time, many scholars tended to view Negritude and ethnic particularism as being a politically motivated ideology somewhere on the left. Césaire, for instance, was a member of the Communist Party until 1956, has been at the helm of his own Martinican Socialist Party since 56, and has, since 1946, been without ever missing a return in an election, a member of the French Chamber of Deputies. There's always been a political implication here. But revision, historical revision, and literary historical revision of such things in recent times has tended to look upon ethnic particularism as a more conservative movement in the Caribbean and elsewhere. To bring this more up to date, I think we would find in the work of a writer like Edouard Glissant, whose Caribbean Discourse was just published in late 1989, in a series that I can't give too strong a plug because I'm the general editor of it, but it's published at the University Press of Virginia. Edouard Glissant, like many others of a younger generation of French West Indians, is much more concerned with the Caribbeanness of one's being. In other words, Caribbean people in the 80s have been much less likely to look for solace, and still less to a home, even a spiritual home, in Africa. I think it's fair to say that from the 80s onward, what we're going to see, most particularly in the Caribbean, and I think elsewhere in the Americas, is more of an awareness of the necessity of our living together where we are, and accepting the historical implications of what we share.
Jim Arnold, what are the educational purposes or goals of this project that you've embarked on, this literary history of the Caribbean? You really have a lot of people, I take it, who don't know much at all about this subject.
It's a curious fact that although the Caribbean is a very productive literary area, and we might in a moment do a little test by running a list of names to see if there are any of our hearers out in radio land who don't recognize at least one of them.
Let's begin with the interviewer.
Well, for instance, you do, of course, know at least about Gabriel Garcia Marquez. It's impossible.
100 Years of Solitude.
Yes,
to mind.
Yes, there's one title that by now every educated person knows, even if he or she has not yet or may never read the novel.
Uh-huh.
And something of the measure of the importance of the Caribbean as a literary area can be measured by such facts as these. Those who follow such things as the attribution of the Nobel Prize for Literature, if they are old enough, will remember that in 1960 that prize went to Saint-Jean Perse from the island of Guadeloupe,
mm-hmm.
A great poet. At the time, considered by many to be the most important poet in French. Derek Walcott, whom I've also mentioned as a foremost poet writing in the English language, refers to Perse as a presence who cannot be ignored by writers of color in the Caribbean. This question of ethnicity, I think, is something that we must attend to very carefully when dealing with the Caribbean. it would be wrong to say that Caribbean literature is black literature and stop there, if we don't then take into account the necessary play. There is, in the first place, the necessity of presenting Caribbean literature as a cultural phenomenon that is related to the areas around it, North, South, and Central America, to be sure, but which has a specificity. And this is of interest not just to specialists. It is potentially of interest to all of us who care about the evolution of culture in the Americas. I hope that it's not pretentious to think that if we do our job well, a literary history like this one can, by inference, tell us something about important questions that we face in the United States as a multi-ethnic society. These questions are always present in the mind of every Caribbean person, where the issue of ethnicity is faced more directly and often more honestly than we tend to do it in the United States.
Is your literary history, Jim Arnold, of the Caribbean an answer to the charge of ethnocentricity? And the citizens of the United States of America? I take it that you think that, yeah, that this is an ethnocentric society.
Yes. I hadn't intended to be quite that blunt about it, but since you forced my hand, yes, we are. And yes, an enterprise such as ours can be taken as a scholarly reply to the ethnocentricity of American readers of literature.
Jim Arnold, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. Are you so bold as to think that your literary history of the Caribbean is going to help or hinder? What's it going to do in terms of our racial relations?
If I were to give a bold yes answer to your question, I would appear...
Yes, that it will help, you mean?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I would appear terribly bold indeed, and I can't really do that. What I can say is that we may hope that insofar as such work as ours will condition teachers and their students to a more open awareness of the multiplicity of cultural experiences in our part of the world, that we can hope that such social change and indeed policy issues may be addressed. This is not going to be a direct result. It would be an indirect result and something that will take a good deal of time.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a conversation with James Arnold of the University of Virginia. During his fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, James Arnold is working on a project entitled Rewriting the Caribbean. Soundings for Black History Month 1990 concludes now with commentary on social equity and public policy in the United States. Here is Beverly Jones of North Carolina Central University.
We are a nation at risk. Young people of all races are at risk and face uncertain futures because of our own negligence in reconciling our values with our national public policy priorities. A public policy that calls for billions of dollars for defense and thousands for the education of our children. Educators, business leaders, and others are deeply concerned that unless we are able to find ways to reduce alienation and the lack of motivation to achieve, we will be faced with a generation of adults who will be unprepared to cope with the demands of a highly technological society. Many young people are disconnected from the basic institutions of this society. They can be found among the high school dropouts. They can be seen on the streets of this nation, wandering around without a compass for direction and without the necessary training for decent paying jobs. Yet school dropout is not a problem affecting minorities, but one which cuts across racial, class, and geographical boundaries. It is estimated that 2/3 of the disconnected students drop out because they no longer view the school as a vehicle for success. Unfortunately, many of our reforms are not directed toward the students with marginal status. Despite our professed interest in the education of our children, each year we underfund vital educational programs. We have not yet been able to pass the daycare bill presently in Congress. We continue to allow children to attend schools that are substandard, that do not have adequate facilities, and they must contend with overworked teachers. The fact is, our teachers are not only responsible for imparting educational knowledge, but for teaching programs, teaching courses on anger reduction and conflict resolution. Our schools have, in fact, become custodial parents for growing numbers of children whose parents cannot cope with the increasing demands of child rearing. What happened to our long-cherished value of an open society in which everyone who works hard should have an opportunity to reach her or his full potential? Why do we give our approval wittingly or unwittingly that there are certain people among us who can never expect to rise above poverty? What can we do? There are many strategies we can use. First, we must continue to organize and advocate for a change in national policy that value human lives and welfare. We must make our voices heard at the ballot box. We must see our children as our national priority. We must believe that change can come, that it is possible, and that we can save our children, ourselves, and our nation. Finally, we must promote values that safeguard the most elementary principles of human welfare at home.
Beverly Jones is a professor of history and director of the Institute on Desegregation at North Carolina Central University. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings for Black History Month 1990 is available on cassette. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Ask for program number 490. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, Environment, Philosophy, and American Social Values. My guests will be Francis Moore LaPay of the Institute for Food and Development Policy and J. Baird Callicott of the University of Wisconsin at Stevens Point. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. This week marks an anniversary for the death of the American anti-slavery leader Frederick Douglass. Before his escape from slavery, he was known as Frederick Augustus Washington Bailey. Douglass died in mid-February 1895. Happy birthday this week to the Washington Monument, which was dedicated in mid-February 1885. The New Yorker magazine celebrates a birthday this week. It was first published in mid-February 1925. 18 years ago this week, President Richard Nixon visited the People's Republic of China. This was the first time an American president had traveled to a country not diplomatically recognized by the United States. Mid-February birthdays include the poet W.H. Auden, born in 1907, Robert Baden Powell, the British Army officer who founded the Boy Scouts and the Girl Guides, born in 1857, W.E.B. Du Bois, the educator and leader of the movement for racial equality, born in mid-February 1868, and Wilhelm Carl Grimm, the German mythologist and author, who was born in 1786. Finally, this week marks an anniversary for the assassination of Cesar Augusto Sandino, the Nicaraguan guerrilla leader, from whom the present-day Sandinistas take their name. Sandino was killed at Managua in mid-February 1934. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities. For Black History Month 1990, part 3 in a series of programs this week on Soundings. James Arnold of the University of Virginia discusses the literary history of the Caribbean. Following that, Beverly Jones of North Carolina Central University offers commentary on social equity and public policy in the United States today. For Black History Month 1990, part 3 in a series of programs this week on Soundings.